This episode is also brought to you by Odmos Pizza in Canby. Handmade awesome pizza plus craft beer, wine, and cider delivered. Order today at 503-263-8444 or visit them online at odmos.com.
Welcome to Now Hear This, Canby,
your source for news.
The threat of a possible teacher strike was avoided this week.
There's a new irresistibly cute creature winning over fans, and its name is Scootaloo.
Sports?
It's like Lucy in the football. You want to kick a field goal, but they take it away from you.
We had to learn how to win.
Goal can't be in the last second of the game!
And interesting conversations.
Because I'm one of the strongest girls ever, and I know that for a fact.
I just really enjoy writing gossip as if I was a bear.
With an old maid daughter that make the best moonshine in the coast.
And if it would have hit me in the face, I think I would have died. I really do.
I guarantee you would have died, man. Are you kidding me?
Welcome to the Now Hear This, Canby podcast. Thanks for listening. I'm Martina Baker, and this is what's happening this week in our community. Canby area residents on Saturday awoke to an eerie deja vu as the sky was turned hazy and yellow by smoke from nearby brush fires, including one that burned 35 acres in and around Milo McIver State Park in Estacada, evoking the start of the disastrous wildfires of September 2020, almost exactly 2 years ago. Meanwhile, an unrelated crash on Knightsbridge Road early that morning knocked out power in parts of Canby, including the police department and wastewater treatment plant. Canby Police Chief George Tro told Now Hear This, Canby, that the outage occurred when a driver fell asleep at the wheel and crashed into a utility pole at the intersection of Knightsbridge and North Ash. Officials also reported shortly after 9 a.m. that crews with Canby Utility and the Canby Public Works Department were hard at work to restore power to affected customers. The Milo McIver fire broke out Friday night on park grounds and spread quickly, prompting evacuations from the campground and surrounding areas, including the Clackamas River, Fellows, and Batoon on the west and south of Fisher's Mill to Metzler Park in Estacada. The four-alarm fire eventually grew to consume an estimated 35 acres, but was reportedly contained as of Saturday morning. Officials have confirmed that more than one home was lost in the blaze, but specific numbers and damage estimates were not yet available. The McIver Park fire is under control, Canby Fire Chief Jim Davis reported shortly after 8 a.m. Saturday. We understand everyone is concerned about the sky looking like it did in 2020 and the spread of the fire. The fire is confirmed as contained and not spreading now. Chief Davis said the smoke Canby area residences were experiencing Saturday morning were from other larger fires burning elsewhere in Oregon, not Milo McIver. Inversion conditions will likely keep the smoke trapped in the Willamette Valley through the weekend, dampening visibility and air quality. The American Red Cross set up shelters for affected residents at Clackamas County College and the Clackamas County Red Soils campus in Oregon City. Battle-tested by the disastrous wildfires of September 2020 and other crises, the rural communities of Clackamas County also banded together this weekend to support displaced residents of Estacada and other areas ordered to evacuate due to the threat of active wildfires. Molalla resident Angie Zeiss, Molalla Mayor Scott Kaiser, and others worked through the early morning hours on Saturday to open the Molalla Buckaroo as a campsite and livestock and animal shelter for Estacadans displaced by the four-alarm fire that burned an estimated 25 acres at Milo McIver State Park. Approximately 550 homes were evacuated in Estacada, with deputies going door-to-door in some areas to notify residents. Many in the area recalled the massive Riverside wildfire that ravaged central and eastern Clackamas County in 2020, displacing thousands in Molalla, Sandy, and Estacada. Fire officials and residents said that the disaster helped better prepare fire crews and volunteers to respond to this year's wildfires and serve those impacted by them. "We all went through it 2 years ago," Zeit said. "I was running the fire evacuation at Clackamas County Fairgrounds for about 16 days. Canby Fire established a fire operations center at its headquarters on South Pine last week, called on additional personnel and stage apparatus and equipment to respond to disasters related to the weather event and red flag conditions as needed. Canby Fire is fully staffed with off-duty personnel and volunteers," Davis told NHT Canby Saturday. "All three stations are staffed 24 hours and will be through the remainder of Saturday. All Canby chief officers are either working at the McIver Fire Dispatch Center or staffing at Canby Fire District." High temperatures approaching the low triple digits, low humidity, and continued east winds persisted through Saturday evening, and Davis urged residents to refrain from making outdoor fires of any kind. Portland General Electric crews were working through the night Saturday evening to inspect lines and restore power to more than 37,000 homes in Clackamas County and surrounding areas that were preemptively shut off due to the high winds and extreme fire conditions. PGE reported at just before 8 p.m. that crews were actively working in all 10 areas that had experienced public safety power shutoffs, including the Mount Hood Corridor and Foothills, Portland West Hills, Tualatin Mountains, Central West Hills, and the Southern West Hills. Crews are patrolling, inspecting, and repairing approximately 1,800 miles of lines so that power may safely be restored, the utility said in a news release. Crews had begun re-energizing lines for affected customers as early as 3 p.m. on Saturday, as visual inspections by PGE personnel, as well as mutual aid from Avista, BC Hydro, PGE, and the Snohomish Public Utility District, confirmed that repairs were not needed in some areas. The utility said it was working with local government officials and fire agencies to establish plans and confirm the extreme weather conditions had abated in the affected service areas. "Safety is our top concern," PGE said. "Crews will work as soon as the weather allows and then as quickly as safely possible to restore the remaining approximately 17,000 customers affected by PGE's proactive outages." Community resource centers will remain open from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. every day until power is fully restored to these areas. Information, bottled water, ice, access to charging for personal devices, and wireless internet will be available. The locations include Welch's Elementary School, Furwood Elementary School in Sandy, Silverton Safeway, Jim's Thriftway in Banks, and Sheridan High School. For the most up-to-date information on power shutoffs, visit portlandgeneral.com/active-psps-info. Much of the state is also under an air quality advisory from the Department of Environmental Quality through at least Monday due to the fires across Oregon and in central Idaho. Smoke can irritate the eyes and lungs and worsen some medical conditions. People most at risk include infants and young children, people with heart or lung disease, older adults, and pregnant people. Residents are advised to take steps to protect themselves and their loved ones, including staying inside if possible, and keeping windows and doors closed. If it's too hot, run air conditioning on recirculate or consider moving to a cooler location. Avoid strenuous outdoor activities. Smoke levels can change rapidly depending on weather. Check the current conditions on the Oregon Smoke Information blog, DEQ's Air Quality Index, or by downloading the free Oregon Air app, which is available on Google Play and the Apple App Store. The Canby Fire District's 21st anniversary 9/11 remembrance ceremony took place on Sunday morning, as planned, thanks to a rapid improvement in the red flag fire conditions that had plagued the area Friday and Saturday. Canby Fire Chief Jim Davis served as Master of Ceremonies, while guest speakers Canby Police Detective Sergeant James Murphy, Mayor Brian Hodson, and Republican gubernatorial nominee and former House Minority Leader Christine Drazen offered reflections on the terrorist attacks that killed nearly 3,000 Americans, launched two decades-long wars, and reshaped global politics for a generation. A presentation of the colors and bell ringing ceremony were performed by Canby Fire personnel with the support of the American Legion and Knights of Columbus. Pursuant to tradition, the Canby Aurora Veterans of Foreign Wars Post and Auxiliary presented flowers to Canby firefighters and first responders in attendance. For photos, visit the Canby Current on Facebook and Instagram at Canby Current. Cougar Country Hometown Sports Coverage is brought to you by Rife and Hunsaker PC. When you need an attorney, turn to the firm Canby has trusted for over 50 years. Call them today at 503-266-3456. For the latest sports news, follow us on Twitter at Cougar Country OR and Instagram at Cougar Country POD. For one night, the clock turned backward, and the Canby football team welcomed age-old former league rival Oregon City to Cougar Stadium on Thursday, ultimately toppling the visiting Pioneers in convincing fashion, 35-25, to improve to 2-0 on the season. Canby and Oregon City no longer share league ties, as the Cougars football left the Three Rivers League in 2020 when the district elected to move down to the 5A classification, and most of the rest of the school's sports joined them this year after the latest redistricting by the OSAA. But thanks to a shortage of OSAA officials and other quirks that led several of the top 5A teams to still face opponents from the larger classification each year, it was Canby versus Oregon City this week. Just like the old days. Narratives abounded for the highly anticipated grudge match, not the least of which was that it was the Pioneers' first trip to Canby since October 25th, 2019, when the Cougs defeated them by a nearly identical score, 35-28, to snap a multi-year 22-game losing streak and kickstart their renaissance. The Cougs have gone 12-6 since that night, mostly at 5A, including a return to the state playoffs last season. But head coach Jimmy Joyce said his players weren't thinking about the history or the storylines as they suited up for Thursday night's game. "Honestly, we never talked about that," he said. "We talked about handling the distractions with a short week and the first week of school. We tried to focus on getting better and being ready to go. If we do that, everything can fall into place." Ready to go was a pretty good summation as the Cougs jumped out to an early 21-0 advantage over the visitors. Leading the way, unsurprisingly, was star junior running back Tyler Canold, who had another sensational game, carrying the rock 33 times to the tune of 252 yards and three touchdowns. But Canold, who was also an all-league honorable mention as a cornerback last season, also made his mark on defense, scooping up a fumble and returning it for the first score of the game. "He is a special kid for sure," Joyce said. "He has the extra gear where he runs harder in the fourth quarter than the first. But it is not just him. The Hogs up front deserve a lot of credit. OC probably outweighed us by 500 pounds across the board, but these Warriors battled hard and allowed Tyler to do what he does." The front line's effectiveness so far this season has been a pleasant surprise, considering the Cougs graduated three All-League first-teamers last year in Casey Langdale, Colin Kennedy, and Lineman of the Year Jacob Strand, a Division I commit at Oregon State University. Most of this year's crew is smaller and much less experienced, but if this year's lineup is any less dominant than last year's elite version, it hasn't translated to the field yet. "The culture surrounding the offensive and defensive lines is one of the most impressive things I have experienced in my football life, and it predates me by years," Joyce said. "To be a Hog here is something special." Coach Paul Huggins and Coach Brett Rhodes do an amazing job. "The only place I know of where kids want to be linemen. Look at Davis Hagen, a backup, running back, and standout linebacker last year, and he asked to be put on the line. That doesn't happen at a lot of places." While Game 1 in Bend saw juniors Parker Ackerman and Gage Millar splitting time at quarterback, Joyce had a different strategy this week, giving Millar the full-time nod while slotting Ackerman in at corner receiver, a role he played well last season. "He's too important. He needs to be on the field all the time, not just every other series," Joyce said of Ackerman, noting that they might employ the same lineup going forward. We'll see what the future holds. Millar performed capably as lead signal caller, albeit in limited opportunities, going 5-for-9 for 61 yards and adding another 24 on the ground. The Cougs even did damage on special teams as junior Cohen Hall recovered a blocked field goal and carted it 90 yards for a touchdown. The Cougs' next challenge will be another curveball as they again suit up on Thursday to play a 6A opponent, Beaverton, on the road. It will be a homecoming for Joyce, who spent 7 years as offensive coordinator there, making the 6A quarterfinals in 2015 and 2016 before taking the head coaching job at Canby. The Beavers dropped their first two games in brutal fashion, losing 41-0 to South Medford and 56-14 to Sprague.
On September 17th, join the FOB Tap Room and other local businesses in Canby's first Oktoberfest, an authentic celebration of German food, beer, and culture. Enjoy over a dozen rare imported German beers carefully selected by FOB owner Steve Puga, including a ceremonial Oktoberfest keg that will be tapped for just this occasion. So be sure to come early and savor the flavors of Bavarian-style bratwurst and pretzels by Ebner's Custom Meats and Bee's Bake Shop, while the sounds of our live Oompa band and other German musical stylings transport you to another age. Don't miss this one-day-only event as we celebrate German food and culture while also honoring and remembering the spirit of the German pioneers and immigrants who helped build Canby and forever left their mark on our community. You can find it only at Fobtoberfest from noon to 9 p.m. Saturday, September 17th at Waite Park in the heart of downtown Canby. For more information, visit fobtaproom.com or find our event on Facebook. FOB Taproom, a place for all friends of beer.
Dude, I'm so excited. When this remodeling project is over, our studio is going to have a full arcade and hot tub. We can play Bubble Bobble with our hot tub bubbles on full blast. Just got to finish downloading these blueprints and we'll be good to go.
Oh yeah, man, it's going to be off the Hey, wait a minute. The plans haven't even downloaded yet? How much time is left?
Not much. It looks like just about 14 hours.
14 hours? Dude, we're not building a skyscraper. It's just a one-room remodel. We have to have those plans today or we won't make our deadline.
Hey, this would not be a problem if somebody hadn't made us hit our data cap for the month by binge-watching the first 4 seasons of Drop Dead Diva last week.
Hey.
We have super slow download speeds anyway, and that just slowed us down even more because some providers reduce user speeds for going over their data limit.
Well, excuse me for being captivated by Brooke Elliott's perfect balance of heart and humor. I'm only human.
Man, let's just switch to DirectLink already. Then we would have unlimited data with upload speeds up to 10 times faster than our current provider. So we can download our plans in a snap, and you can keep binge-watching all your guilty pleasures.
Okay, I give. Please, call DirectLink and get us set up. I need that hot tub, and I do still have 2 seasons Drop Dead Diva to watch.
For uploads and downloads at the speed of work, visit www.directlink.coop/internet or give them a call at 503-266-8111.
What is your name? And tell us a little bit about yourself.
Well, my name is Tony Crawford, and I'm currently a retired teacher from the Canby School District. I spent my entire teaching career teaching here in Canby, initially at Knight Elementary School, but most of my career at Ackerman Middle School, where I taught 7th grade world geography and a little bit of 8th grade U.S. history.
All right. And where were you when you heard about 9/11 or first realized what was happening?
So specifically, when I first heard what was happening the morning of September 11th, I had finished a little morning run and then, you know, came home and, you know, showered and got dressed and was ready to start my day, you know, over at Ackerman. And so I got into the car and turned on the car radio, and there were serious news reports going on, something like I'd never heard before. I immediately ran back into the house, told Betty, my wife, hey, turn on the television, something's going on. I'm heading to school so I can get ready how to deal with this during the day. In my geography class, we oftentimes would just abandon the day's scheduled lesson if there was some breaking news story. I always told my students the first question a geographer would ask is where, and then the second question would be why there. So we needed to find out what was going on with current events, and you know, and as this breaking news story was taking place, I knew that that was going to be the focus of my day in my classroom.
Was there anything else about the day that you remember?
Oh my gosh. So the first question was just trying to make sure that we had accurate information all throughout the day. And of course it was being updated, you know, as the day was going on. So wanted to make sure that we separated, you know, factual information from rumors. But the ultimate question that my students would ask is, you know, why? Why is this happening? What's going on? Why is this? And so what I initially went to was, you know, a few years prior to September 11th, we did have the attack on the World Trade Center in New York City. And at that particular time, it was a couple of extremists from the PLO who had planted some bombs down in the basement. And so if we remember that story, then I thought, well, there might be a link, you know, maybe this is the same group trying to revisit, this opportunity to attack the World Trade Center. As it turns out, that wasn't the case, but that was the first thought in terms of trying to make some sense out of what was going on that day.
So, you know, you talk about working through the facts and the rumors and, you know, establishing what you're going to be talking about with your students. What were you feeling? What was your emotional reaction as more information was coming out?
Oh my gosh, I was frightened. You know, this was a serious attack on U.S. soil. I was trying to think of other moments in U.S. history where maybe, you know, something similar took place. I thought a lot about Pearl Harbor. And what, you know, the generation older than me, you know, what they went through on that particular day. And so I just found myself, I'm trying to think how to describe it. I was all worked up, but then at the same time, I knew my responsibility and my obligation, you know, to my students. And so one memory I do have was I went through the entire day without breaking down. You know, I just tried to, you know, be strong and to be, you know, steady, you know, as a teacher for my students. And then when I went home that day and, you know, and I saw the television reports, you know, and the replay of the planes, you know, flying into the World Trade Center. At that moment, I just busted up and, you know, broke down in tears, and it was the first time that day. But it was all the emotion just pent up and built up during the day.
What do you think was the biggest impact that 9/11 had on you personally, not just, you know, for the country and your community, but you personally?
It changed me. You know, one of the things that, you know, immediately came out of the experience was, you know, this feeling like a victim, you know, that somehow when one of us is hurt, we're all hurt. But then, you know, what I witnessed, and even within myself, was, you know, this rise, you know, I get knocked down, but I'm going to get back up. And when I get back up, I'm going to be stronger, and I'm going to be formidable. And what I remember just witnessing was how all across our country, and in every community, even right here, you know, in Canby, you know, people pulled together, and you know, and we found strength and comfort, you know, with each other. And one of the memories I have was, you know, we had a gathering over at the high school auditorium, just an interdenominational gathering to pray, you know, for peace, you know, and to pray for the victims of that day, and you know, and of course there was all of this uncertainty, what's going to happen next, and you know, that anytime we're faced with the unknown, you know, that's a challenge. You know, it's a challenge for myself. It's a challenge for any of us. What's next?
Is there anything else you'd like to tell me, a student, about, or my whole generation, about 9/11?
You know, one of the things that I would just say to anyone is that, you know, yes, we can read about an event like this in, you know, the history books. We can watch film. You know, we can see, you know, the big picture of such an event. But really, what made itself known, you know, with that particular day, is that it wasn't just one big event that took place. It was hundreds and thousands of personal stories, and I've lost count of the number of people that I've encountered where we've exchanged our personal stories that relate to September 11th. You know, one of my own personal stories was just the day before, September 10th, I was on the phone with one of my colleagues from National Geographic Society. His name was Joe Ferguson. He was their education program director. And I had just worked that summer in Alaska with Joe and his colleague Ann on one of our National Geographic projects. At that time, I was a teacher consultant for National Geographic, and I'd get frequently called to work on field projects with them. So as it turns out, we had a project the following week scheduled in Florida. And so Joe was on the phone with me September 11th, and he tells me, he says, "Oh, Tony, you're not going to believe this schedule I have. I have to fly out to California tomorrow, and then I've got to fly back." And we discovered that our flights were going to be arriving about the same time in Florida at Miami. And so we agreed we'd find each other in the airport, and then we'd share a ride, you know, out to the hotel that we're going to be at. So, you know, he says, "Well, I'll see you next week," and "Yeah, I'll see you then, Joe. Have a safe flight." Turns out those were my last words to him. What I learned on September 12th, and this was when all flights were canceled all across the country, I was expecting that our project with National Geographic was going to probably at least be postponed, if not outright canceled. So I was waiting for a call from them. So on the 12th, sure enough, I get a phone call from National Geographic, and I said, "Oh, I've been waiting for your call. I'm expecting our project's probably canceled." And they said, "Well, Tony, yeah, it's canceled, but this call is worse than that." I said, "What do you mean?" And they said, "Joe and Ann were both on the plane." And that's all they needed to say. I knew what they meant. Joe Ferguson and his colleague Ann Judge, they were both on the plane that went into the Pentagon. So I lost two good friends that day, and I still cherish their memory. I still try to do things that that, you know, would honor, you know, their legacy. But I will say that later in November, that fall, my wife Betty and I, we had opportunity to attend a conference in Washington, D.C. And we made it a point to go out to the Pentagon, where at that time, you know, the wall, you know, that whole section that was struck by the plane was still destroyed and quite visible and quite shocking to see. But we had a makeshift memorial out in the parking lot, and so we both went out there to that particular site and contributed some items in memory of both Joe and Ann that day. So, yeah.
So you went through a lot, I mean, immediately after 9/11. And then you started working on something else. Tell us about the Peace Garden.
So one of the things that we wanted to do is we didn't want this to just be something that, you know, the whole 9/11 event, you know, to be something that would just bring us down. We have to rise back, you know, bounce back from it. And what we had already in place was plans to take part of the grounds at Ackerman Middle School. In fact, it used to be the crummiest part of the whole campus. It was just rock hard dirt, and they had a bike rack there, and it was just maybe the ugliest part of the whole campus. And so what we wanted to do is we wanted to convert this into a peace garden. And this was something that was initiated in the spring of 2001. So it predates September 11th. But we were launching plans for this peace garden. And when I say we, it was all done by our students, you know, the students that I had in my student peace advocacy group at Ackerman, and in the student body in general. But then when September 11th took place, it just enhanced and accelerated our interest in wanting to create this peace garden. And so as we started making plans for the Peace Garden and started actually breaking ground and developing the space, which has eventually become the Ackerman Peace Garden, we recognized we needed a centerpiece. And so my colleague, Will Greenleaf, who was an exceptional teacher, still is. Anyway, he had all of his students launch a letter writing campaign to representatives in the United States government, you know, members of Congress and the president, and, you know, so all of these letters went out. Now, talk about variables. It happened to be that these letters went from our students to Washington, D.C. At the same time, there was the anthrax scare, and so not all of the mail was necessarily making it to its destination. But we had one contact who always kind of remained close with us here in Canby, and especially in our schools, and that was Representative Darlene Hooley. And so I'm contacted by Representative Hooley, and we talked about what the desire was, and the desire was this: to see if we could obtain a relic from the World Trade Center and to honor that relic by making it the centerpiece of the Ackerman Peace Garden. So immediately, Representative Hooley had her staff go to work on trying to secure a relic. And sure enough, a few days later, I get a phone call from her staff person, Suzanne Coons, and she says, "We have it. We have your relic." And so it was put into safekeeping and then was arranged through a donation by UPS to travel from first New York to Washington, D.C., and then from Washington, D.C. to Portland, and then eventually to the UPS center in Tualatin. So what takes place then is We have finally completed construction of the Peace Garden, and we're going to plan on the first anniversary of September 11th, the dedication of the Peace Garden. And so to do this, we, you know, naturally it was a whole school effort, but we wanted to include our community. And so we reached out to, you know, Canby Fire District and Canby Police Department. And in total, what we did was we brought all of our first responders, police and fire, into this plan. But we added one more group. We brought in the American Legion as well. So it was police, fire, and military. And so now we went to the effort of having to pick up the relic from the Tualatin UPS station and bring it to Canby. And so that became like a big deal itself. And so all of this was being done prior to September 11th. We actually have a parade of vehicles, police and fire vehicles, and a bus of Ackerman students. We all take off and we go to Tualatin, where we're then received at this ceremony at the UPS station. And so they bring out the relic. And then Fire Chief Ted Coons, he signed for the package. There was a ceremonial signing for the package, and then the relic was loaded onto the fire engine, and then our parade returned back to Canby. And when we arrived in Canby on Grant Street, we were going to deliver the relic to Waite Park for a little ceremony there. And what we discovered was the Woodburn Fire District and the Tualatin Fire District each had their ladder trucks with the ladders fully raised and this mammoth American flag hanging over the center of Grant Street. And so our parade of vehicles pass underneath this flag, and then we stop there at Waite Park and offload the relic and bring it up to the gazebo. And, you know, we had some speeches and a little ceremony, and the American Legion fired a 21-gun salute. And it was a very special day, but I'm reminded about how our community, you know, it just brought out the best in all of us. But what was interesting as we were trying to direct our respect and attention to both, you know, the fire and police and military as well, you know, all three groups, the leaders of all three groups says, none of this would not have happened had it not been for the students, that the students were the true leaders in all of this. So I was very proud of my students. It brought out the best in them. And you know, as I said, it brought out the best in our community.
One final question. With what all these students did, the writing letter campaign and everything that they did with the student peace advocacy and the Peace Garden, what sort of conversations were you having with these students? How would they respond to these things? And what sort of things were you able to teach them as all this went on?
You know, so one of the things that, you know, I remember constantly addressing with my students is, you know, we can't always control what comes to us, but what we can control is how we respond and how we react. And, you know, even if something appears to be difficult, or even if we're confronted with a tragedy, we can find a way to make something positive, to make some good out of it. And so even when things seem bleak, you know, still we can look for something positive that we can bring out of it. And I think, you know, this was something that my students recognized. Yeah, things are bad, but we can turn it into something good. And they did, they truly did. You know, the Peace Garden to this day, you know, is a monument, you know, to our community. And I know people who just go over there to sit for quiet reflection, to offer prayer, just to reflect on, you know, maybe something that's going on in their lives. And since that day, since that dedication, you know, other elements have been added to the Peace Garden, commemorating visits, you know, from other recognized, you know, leaders, you know, from our country and from our world. And so, so you know, again, it would not have taken place had it not been for the initiation, you know, of our students and the follow-through of our students. So our students prove themselves to be good leaders of the community.
All right. Awesome. Tony, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Hey Tyler, read any good books lately?
Yeah, actually I'm reading a really good one right now.
Awesome, what's it about?
It's kind of complicated, but there's like these two kids with an absent parent, and then this mysterious stranger shows up with his sinister accomplices, and they just start wreaking havoc in their lives. I think it's like a Faustian metaphor.
Wow, that sounds really dense.
It is.
Interesting though, who wrote it?
You know, I think it's like a doctor, starts with like an S or something, Sass, Sos.
Tyler, are you reading The Cat in the Hat?
Yeah, I mean, I'm trying to. It's taken me like 2 months to get this far.
Okay, well, hey, whatever your interest or reading level, open the world of all things books at the Book Nook in downtown Canby.
Yeah, guys, this local, independently owned and operated store is your one-stop shop for the latest releases and great deals on a huge variety of previously owned books, as well as games, art, and writing supplies and gifts.
They also do book clubs and game nights if you're looking for some fun, healthy activities right here in Canby. And hey, you know, for you, Tyler, they have a really expansive selection of children's books.
Oh, cool. Anyway, check them out on Facebook and Instagram, online at booknookcanby.com, or stop by 294 Northwest 2nd Avenue and let their friendly staff introduce you to your new favorite read. Hey, Frankie, why do you think I'd be interested in children's books?
We'll talk about it later.
Oh, okay.
I'm Roz Mason, Democratic candidate for Senate District 26. I'm deeply honored to announce I've also been endorsed by the Independent Party of Oregon. Next time, I'll talk inflation. Here's some context before my next ad. If the income distribution from 1947 to 1974 had held steady, regular people's income would be double today. Instead, income inequality exploded. The top 1% of Americans have taken $50 trillion from the bottom 90%. That's from the title of a Time magazine article you can find online. How did it happen? Wall Street finance deregulation, massive stock buybacks for executive salaries and shareholder profits, overtime rules and the right to unionize being chipped away, allowing mergers and acquisitions. So now a few companies have near monopolies. We can do better. Until next time, this was paid for by Mason for Oregon 21968.
Tell me your name and a little bit about yourself.
My name is Sean Stone. I'm an emergency medicine physician. I'm the medical director for four fire departments, Canby, Malala, Colton, and Estacada. I'm also one of the medical team managers for one of 28 federal terrorist and disaster response teams through the Department of Homeland Security and FEMA. And on September 11th, I was working in that capacity with one of those 28 teams, which responded to the Trade Center.
Well, you already started to answer that question, but the next question is, where were you on 9/11?
So I was actually in Portland, Maine. I was living in Portland, Maine. I was a resident, and in residency training, there's always a single day every month where education is focused on, and there's lectures and teaching seminars in the morning hours. And we were in those seminars, and somebody came running in and said, turn on the TV. And like most of America, we witnessed the very beginnings of the attack on the Trade Center. And at that point, none of the buildings had collapsed. And Portland, Maine is only a short drive, five and a half hours from New York City. And I had moved to Maine from New York City just a couple years before then. So I was working as a resident and saw the first tower go down and turned to my residency director and said, I'm going to New York. And he said, no problem. And I called the hospital where I did my internship, which is one of the Columbia University hospitals, and talked to some friends of mine in the ER there and said, had you seen any patients yet? And they said, no. And I said, well, I'm coming. And they said, good, we'll look forward to seeing you. And then I got a phone call from one of my mentors, one of my residency advisors and professors. And he told me, come with me. I'm on a federal disaster and terrorist response team, and I guarantee you, you will see more if you come with me than if you go to your hospital where you used to work. And he was right. And I was sworn in to the team on the way down to the Trade Center on the 11th.
How far is the drive from Portland?
Normally, it'd be 5.5 hours from Portland, Maine. Our base was outside of Boston in a town called Beverly, Massachusetts. So we first went to the base, and then we assembled all of our equipment and gear, which was loaded up onto 18-wheelers, and we drove. And we were the first federal disaster and response team into the Trade Center after the collapse.
How long had it been?
We had our first people on scene at around 11 p.m. that night.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay. So the night of.
Yeah. What was that like?
It was intense. We were the primary search and rescue team on scene, along with the New York City Fire Department. The FDNY was the head team for all of the search and rescue activity, but under their banner, they had pulled us in, and we worked side by side with them. We shared our command tent with them. We had the primary search and rescue responsibilities for the first 7 days.
What did you see? What did you experience? What do you remember? I mean, everyone else we've talked to for this project is describing their experiences of watching it on TV.
Yeah. As you'd expect, TV did not do much justice to what the real event was like. And I didn't see anything on TV until after I got back. You know, I saw the first tower go down. I didn't even see the second tower go down until after I had come back, because everything from that point forward was just a very significant amount of chaos and rushing, and then getting down to New York and then coming home and then seeing television for the first time a week later. I don't know how to even begin describing the things that I saw in New York City. As a person who was born in New York City and who grew up for the most part in New Jersey, just outside of Manhattan, the Trade Center was very personal to me. I have a lot of friends that would take the subway into the Trade Center every morning. My grandfather was a judge. His courtroom was in the South Tower, and I used to visit him there as a child. And fortunately, he had long since passed away and was not in the tower when they went down. So there was a lot of personal attachment for me to the Trade Center and the whole experience. For me, it was very odd to walk through the streets of Manhattan that I know very well and see an entire sector of the city black with no power, with doors wide open, with abandoned cars on the street, and this is before you even got to the area of direct destruction, where it was just block after block of abandoned, completely quiet Manhattan streets. I've never seen that in my life. Manhattan is never quiet. Even at 4 a.m, there's people wandering around, people banging, you know, leaning on horns and cars everywhere. And to see that, just no power, this ghost town, it was weird. It was very bizarre. And then to see the collapse of the towers, you know, our tents were between buildings 4 and 5 of the Trade Center complex. So we were staring right into the crater the whole time we were there. And we were crawling our bellies through the collapsed structure to look for void spaces where survivors might be. And we would breach into cars that were covered in rubble. And my team searched the entire subterranean mall underneath the Trade Center. We searched all the surrounding buildings. It was intense. Yeah. Buildings were still burning while we were in them.
Yeah. Did you find survivors?
We found, no. We found deceased individuals and portions of bodies. I mean, it was, I don't want to be too graphic, but yeah, it was intense, and we didn't find a survivor within the Trade Center complex. One of our fellow teams, a Pennsylvania team, found a woman that was injured in one of the buildings just south of the Trade Center complex, and she had been there for a couple of days when they found her. So,
wow, that's good.
Yeah, most of the walking wounded got out on their own.
Yeah. So you were young. How old at the time? 20s?
I got it. How old am I?
Subtract 20.
31.
Yeah. Just emotionally, what do you remember thinking, feeling, processing? Like you say, you know, coming across people that died, their body parts, you know, again, not to get too graphic, but I guess how did you and kind of the team, do you remember how you guys talked about it? Was there no talking? I mean, just what were those interactions like? Or is it hard to sort of remember?
No, they're vivid memories.
Yeah.
There's a lot to your question. There was a transition. You know, the initial feelings were of shock and surprise and just trying to comprehend and take in everything that we were witnessing. And then that quickly kind of morphed into anger, sadness. And I can distinctly remember the first time that anybody cracked a joke. I think we'd been on scene for 3 nights. The team's split in half. And so that we search 24 hours a day, we have completely symmetric two halves of the same team, if you will. And I was on the night crew and we would search all night long. And then the morning crew would come and relieve us at 7 a.m. and we would go and try and sleep for a few hours. And nobody wanted to crack a joke. We're working with the New York City Police Department search and rescue units, which are called ESU units. We're working with the Port Authority Police Department. We're working with the FDNY, and they had all lost friends. And many times we're pulling out respirators from the pile and having them identify which one of their colleagues it was because they wore different respirators. So pretty morbid stuff. And we were searching a building called the Century 21 building, which is just east of the Trade Center complex. And it's a big building. It's probably 50 stories and it stares right at the Trade Center. So the people that were there had a first front row view of everything that took place. And when we got into the building, we were searching every floor. There's no power, so we're climbing all the stairs. And you could see phones dangling on their cords. You could see purses and briefcases left where people just split and ran for their lives. So it was a very weird, bizarre snapshot of this huge, these massive floors, empty offices with people's belongings just left where they ran. And some of the rooms were locked, and so we would have to force entry into the rooms to make sure there was nobody in there. Pretty typical search and rescue fire stuff. And I remember we were about halfway up the building, and there's a device that firefighters use called a rabbit ear, which broke. And so somebody had to bring another one up, and they had to run up 20 flights of stairs to get it to us. So we were taking a break and drinking some Gatorade and waiting. And I'm not a patient person, and I don't like to wait. And so I turned to the firefighters who were there, and I said, I thought you guys were firefighters. What are we waiting for? A tool? Let's kick some doors in. And I kicked the door in, and the New York City Police Special Response Unit, which is called the ESU, they had one of their crews with us, and they said, who the heck is that guy? And my teammate said, that's our team doc. And so one of the ESU guys said, what's he, a podiatrist? And it was just a moment of levity that finally needed to occur because nobody had made a joke for 3 days, and it broke the ice. And then after that, everybody could, you know, we were waiting for the New Yorkers to give us the cue, you know, that it was okay to have a different level of social interaction. So there's a lot of little anecdotes like that, a lot of different emotions.
Again, not to get graphic, don't want to hear about body parts or things, but are there personal effects or things that you came across that were kind of affected you emotionally, you know, or that like, oh my gosh, you know, this was, you know, told a story to you?
Yeah, there was a lot of that. In fact, I've got some beautiful slides. I've given some slide presentations over the last 20 years with some pretty amazing things. The worst case scenario handbook, which is kind of a joke book that sold millions of copies. We found it completely undestroyed, lying half opened on top of building 5 next to a piece of the fuselage from one of the jets. I mean, it was surreal that this would be there. We found all sorts of things that were amazing to behold. I remember in the wee hours of the morning entering into a crater opening at the base of the South Tower with about 8 or 9 other search and rescue team members, and we're crawling on our bellies and leaving little glow sticks behind us every 100 feet or so you could find your way out. And we started as 8, and within a few minutes there was just me and one of my teammates, and everybody else was separated and somewhere else in this maze of the pile as it lies, and you're just crawling on your belly trying to find a void space with somebody in it. And we got to about maybe 50 feet below the crater. And we, and I could see with my headlamp that we had reached what used to be the level of the asphalt. And you could see this line of asphalt all the way around us. And I could see the completely crushed remains of what used to be a newspaper stand. And there was magazines and newspapers filling in the next layer down of almost like a cake. You know, there was different layers. And it was so surreal to be inside of this architectural bit of chaos where you're looking at what used to be 150 feet above you, or maybe 100 feet above you. Yeah, wild.
Yeah. Do you remember feeling scared that, you know, that there might be, that it might collapse farther?
All the time.
Yeah.
We would turn our cell phones on, and because we had cell phone scanners, and we would put them in our leg bags of our BDUs and our leg pockets. And the whole idea was that if the pile shifted while you were in there, it would be perhaps one means by which they could track you down and get you out in time. So we were, the first two nights, there was evacuation alarms sounding every 45 minutes or so. It's three short bursts on an air horn, and anybody can do it. And the idea was that one of the buildings was coming down on top of us, one of the surrounding buildings. And after 10 or 15 episodes of that, where everybody just drops their tools and runs in different directions, it started to get bizarre, because you're constantly under the fear that another building's going to crash and land on top of you. And these are some very big buildings. There was an enormous amount of fear. And I was in the basement of Building 5 when it went up in flames. And we all jumped on the hoses that the firefighters purposely leave just for that kind of a reignition moment. And we were putting it out from inside. We had no idea how big it actually was. It was pretty darn big. And the whole time we were underground, our task force leader was watching very cautiously and deciding whether to pull us out. But they felt that they had it under control, and they left us down there.
Yeah.
But it was, for somebody who had never been in a building on fire before, it was surreal.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Did you have any, as an outsider who came to help, did you have interactions either with the police and first responders you were working with, or with other residents of New York City, where they expressed their gratitude to you, or just, you know, had a moment with them?
All of the above. I had incredibly intimate moments with New York firefighters, New York police officers. We shared our command tent, as I mentioned, with the FDNY, and that's a pretty significant statement, because we were, the head of the Office of Emergency Management was with us all the time, and we got to know him very well. I got to know him quite well. And so we had a lot of very direct interactions with the people who were calling the shots. And as far as the New Yorkers were concerned, it was nothing short of beautiful. We had kids coming down, young kids in their 20s, wearing dust masks and carrying boxes with sandwiches and Gatorade, trying to feed us. And we kept telling them, get out of here. This is an unsafe area. We still thought the buildings were unstable around us. The Millennium Hilton was a massive building. It was marked as unstable. And if that had fallen, it would have taken out many, many people. And these kids were Asian, African, East African. These kids from the Caribbean. These kids were from all over the world. And it was such a beautiful New York moment, because they were risking their own lives just to come and help in the way they could. So there was a lot of beautiful moments like that. Yeah.
That is beautiful. Okay. Well, it's been 20 years. What would you say that maybe some of the biggest impacts that this experience had on you personally?
Well, it was my own personal experience. It was my entry point into working through the urban search and rescue apparatus of the federal government's disaster response units, and I've loved working in that capacity ever since. There are amazing men and women that work in that field that will spend most of their careers never even recognized for the work that they do. And it's an amazing, I'm glad that field exists, and I'm glad that those people are there, and I'm glad that there is an apparatus to help pull people out of bad situations, because they're very well trained, they're very well equipped, and they do amazing work when they need to. And it was my entry point into this universe, so I'm very happy that happened. It's been a very fulfilling part of my career. Mm-hmm. It also gave me the opportunity to appreciate paramedics and first responders in a way that I never comprehended before. And strangely enough, has led to me working with them on a regular basis now, and I owe that all entirely to my experience at the Trade Center. Mm-hmm. So it's changed my life.
Yeah, absolutely. What about the sort of larger events of 9/11, the attack, the terrorist attack of it all? did that have an impact on you, as it did all of us?
I don't think it changed my worldview much. I was a pretty careful student of politics, have been my whole life. I minored in political science. I taught a political science college as a TA in undergrad. So I had a keen appreciation for international politics. Yeah. So it didn't change my life in that regard. I've got a chronic cough. I use inhalers now, you know, because of the Trade Center. So it's changed my life in a lot of ways. But I don't think it changed my worldview at all. I think my worldview's remained unchanged.
Yeah. The experience that you had and just 9/11 in general, is there anything, and again, we're talking to the next generation, mm-hmm. any beyond what we've already talked about, anything specific that you would like them to know or learn from your experiences?
Sure. I suppose probably a lot of things. I think, number one, you can always make a difference. You may be a long distance away from a calamity, but you can actually make a huge difference. And I'll give you a good example. My boots were badly damaged on the first day of the deployment, and they really were not firefighter regulation boots. They were, you know, pretty utilitarian boots, but the soles were badly damaged on the first day. And so I went into the bottom of the Javits Convention Center where we were sleeping and we were using as a base. And it was the first day after the Trade Center, September 12th, and there was thousands of parcels and boxes coming in from all over the country, from good people who simply were sending what they thought might be helpful and be useful. And I found a box with a bunch of boots, and there was probably 7 pairs of boots. And I found a pair that fit me, and they had steel toes. And in each pair of boots was a little note from a gentleman who gave his first name and his first initial and last name in Brooklyn, New York. And it says, "I hope these boots get to where they need to be." And actually, 2 of my teammates also took boots from this box, and we used them for the rest of our deployment. And I got home and tracked this person down and thanked him and said, "Listen, so you understand, your boots got to where they were supposed to be, and thank you, because it helped keep me safe, it helped keep my feet safe, it kept me operational and in the field." And it was such a beautiful gesture on the part of this man who didn't even know for sure that the boots were going to get there, and he could only afford to buy 7 pairs of boots, so he bought 7 pairs of boots, typed the note, and put it in there, and I still have the note to this day. So I think the message I would give you is that if you care about something and you feel like you want to do something, go with that gut instinct. You can make a difference, even if you're 1,000 miles away, 3,000 miles away. We were receiving packages from people in other countries, whether it was supplies or food, and a lot of it got used. So follow that, and you can make a big difference, even if you're a long way away.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much, Sean.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Tyler, did you know that the Australian lyrebird can mimic any sound that it hears? Even chainsaws?
No, that's super interesting.
Did you know that a baby puffin is called a puffling? Or no. That baby sea otters can't swim, so their moms wrap them up in pieces of kelp until they learn how to paddle?
Wait, do you know any trivia that isn't like animal related?
Not really, but here's some stuff you may not know about the Wild Hare Saloon, where Camby goes to eat and have fun.
Okay.
The Wild Hare is one of Camby's longest running locally owned restaurants. Owners Joan and Darren Moden have been in business for 16 years.
That's cool.
Yep. Heck, you were just a baby back then. And they love to give back. They've been members of the Camby Chamber for that long, and they donate over $20,000 to local sports, FFA programs, and civic organizations each year.
Wow, I'm legitimately like caught off. That's cool.
Yeah. They also support more than 30 jobs in the community through their award-winning staff, some of them as young as 18. Hey, that's older than you are.
Dude, I'm 10 months younger than you.
With the days getting longer and the weather getting warmer, the Camby Wild Hare's expansive outdoor patio is the place to be. Furry friends, welcome.
Well, that sounds great. I'm going to go check them out just off of Highway 99E next to the Space Age in Camby at 1656 Beaver Creek Road in Oregon City, or on their website at thewildhairsaloon.net. Now Hear This, Camby is produced by me, Tyler Clausen. Our content director and star reporter is Tyler Frankie. And of course, our show is edited by Cameron Clausen. We also feature the vocal talents of Joy Struby and James Walden. So a round of applause to them. The song that you're hearing right now is Camby by singer-songwriter Olivia Harms. used with her permission. To find more work from her, you can visit her website, olivia13.com.
Now Hear This Canby is dedicated to preserving independent local journalism and redefining local news with our fun, fresh, and energetic brand of storytelling. Our sincere thanks to our local sponsors who make this show possible. Please show your appreciation by supporting the small businesses who support us.
The production of Now Hear This Studios, Canby's locally owned, full-service audio, video, and media production company. Our mission is to produce the best content in the universe, and we'd love to help you do it. Find us online at nhtstudios.com.
I will take a motion to adjourn.
I just moved it.
I didn't even ask for it, though.